For weeks they waited at the bedside of the Mahdi. Chief among them was Khalifa Abdullahi. Then there was the Ashraf, the Mahdi's brothers, uncles and cousins, and the emirs of the tribes, the Jalan, the Hadendawa, the Beja, and others. The Mahdi had no sons, so if he should die, the succession was uncertain. There were only two women in his sick room, both heavily veiled and sitting unobtrusively in a far corner. The first was his principal wife, Aisha. The second was the concubine, Al-Yamal. Not only was she his current favourite, but it was well known that she possessed great medical skills. Together, these two women waited out the long and uncertain course of his disease. Rebecca's Abyssinian cure seemed highly effective during the first stages of the illness. She mixed the powder with boiled water, and she and Aisha prevailed upon the Mahdi to drink copious draughts of it. As with Amber, his body was drained of fluids by the scouring of his bowels and the prolonged vomiting, but between them the two women were able to replace the liquid and mineral salts he had lost. It was 14 days before the patient had started along the road to full recovery, and prayers of thanksgiving were held at every hour in the new mosque below his window. When he could sit up and eat solid food, the city resounded to the beat of drums and volleys of rapturous rifle fire. The following day, the Mahdi complained of insect bites. Like most of the other buildings in the city, the palace was infested by fleas and lice, and his legs and arms were speckled with red swellings. They fumigated the room by burning branches of the turpentine bush in a brazier. However, the Mahdi scratched the flea bites, and soon a number were infected with the feces of the vermin that had inflicted them. The temperature of his body soared, and he suffered alternating bouts of fever and chill. He would not eat. He was prostrated by nausea. The doctors thought that these symptoms were a complication of the cholera. Then, on the 16th day, the characteristic rash of typhus fever covered most of his body. By this time he was in such a weakened condition that he sank rapidly. Near the end he asked the two women to help him to sit up, and in a faint, unsteady voice he addressed all the important men crowded around his angareb.
"The Prophet Muhammad, who sits on the right hand of Allah, has come to me, and he has told me that the Khalifa Abdullahi must be my successor on earth. Abdullahi is of me, and I am of him. As you have obeyed me and treated me, so must you obey and treat him. Allah is great, and there is no other God but Allah."
He sagged back onto the bed and never spoke again. The men around the bed waited, but the tension in the crowded room was even more oppressive than the heat and the odour of fever and disease. The Ashraf whispered among themselves and watched the Khalifa Abdullahi surreptitiously. They believed that their blood tie to the Mahdi superseded all else. Surely the right to take possession of the vacant seat of power belonged to one of their number. However, they knew that their claim was weakened by the last decree of the Mahdi, and by the sermon he had preached in the new mosque only weeks before he fell ill. Then he had reprimanded his relatives for their luxurious living, their open pursuit of wealth and pleasure.
"I have not created the Mahdiya for your benefit. You must give up your weak and wicked ways. Return to the principles of virtue I have taught you, which are pleasing to Allah," he had ranted, and the people remembered his words.
Even though the claim of the Ashraf to the Mahdiya was flawed, if one or two powerful emirs of the fighting tribes declared for them, Abdullahi would be sent to the execution grounds behind the mosque to meet his god and follow his Mahdi into the fields of paradise. Sitting quietly beside Aisha at the end of the room, Rebecca had learned enough of dervish politics to be aware of the nuances and undercurrents that agitated the men. She drew back the folds of her veil to ask Aisha if she might take a dish of water to bathe the fevered face of the dying Mahdi.
"Leave him be," Aisha replied softly. "He is on his way to the arms of Allah, who, even better than we can, will love and cherish him through all eternity."
It was so hot and muggy in the room that Rebecca kept her veil open a little longer, making the most of a sluggish movement of air through the tiny windows across the room. She felt an alien gaze upon her and flicked her eyes in its direction. The Emir Osman Atalan of the Beja was contemplating her bare face steadily, and though his dark eyes were implacable, she knew he was looking at her as a woman, a young and beautiful woman who would soon be without a man. She could not look away. Her eyes were held by a force beyond her control, as the compass needle is held by the lodestone. Though it seemed an age, it was only a few moments before Abdullahi leaned towards Osman Atalan and spoke to him so softly that his lips hardly moved. Osman turned his head to listen and broke the spell that had existed between him and the young woman. "How do you stand, noble Emir Atalan?" Abdullahi whispered, and his voice was so low that nobody else in the room could overhear. "The East is mine," Osman said. "The East is yours," Abdullahi agreed. "The Hadendawa, the Yalin, and the Beja are my vassals." "They are your vassals," Abdullahi acknowledged. "And you are mine?" "There is one other small matter." Osman procrastinated a moment longer, but Abdullahi was ahead of him. "The woman with the yellow hair." So, he had seen the exchange of glances between Osman and Al-Yamal. Osman nodded. Like the rest of them, Abdullahi lusted after this exotic creature with her pale golden hair, blue eyes, and ivory skin. But to him, she was not worth the price of an empire. "She is yours," Abdullahi promised. "Then I am the vassal of Abdullahi, the successor of the Mahdi, and I will be as the Taj on his shoulder and the blade in his right hand." Suddenly the Mahdi opened his eyes and stared at the ceiling. He uttered a cry, "Oh, Allah!" Then the air rushed from his lungs. They covered his face with a white sheet, and the opposing factions faced each other across the cooling body. The Ashraf stated their case, which was based on their holy blood. Against this, the Khalifa Abdullahi's case was manifest. He did not have the blood, but he had the word and blessing of the Mahdi. Still it hung in the balance. The newborn empire teetered on the verge of civil war. "Who declares for me?" asked the Khalifa Abdullahi. Osman Atalan rose to his feet and looked steadily into the faces of the emirs of the tribes that traditionally owed him allegiance. One after the other they nodded. "I declare for the word and wish of the Holy Mahdi. May Allah love him forever," said Osman. "I declare for the Caliphate Abdullahi." Every man in the room shouted in homage to the new ruler, the Caliphate of the Sudan, although the voices of the Ashraf were muted and lacked enthusiasm.